buildings, they made laws that are still in use today. And people could trade and travel safely across huge distances. And they called it Pax Romana, or the Roman peace, a period of about 200 years. Now, life wasn't perfect, but for many it was pretty good. You could watch gladiator games, go to chariot races, theater performances, go to public baths, although I wouldn't do that, and enjoy stuff from all around the world. If you were a Roman citizen, you had rights and could even vote. People thought Rome would last forever. But beneath the surface, things were starting to rot. The old Roman values of duty, discipline, and loyalty began to fade. Leaders got greedy and corrupt. The rich got richer and the poor got poorer. Sexual promiscuity, that's a hard word, and adultery increased. And a rise in hedonism in pursuit of pleasure. People cared more about wild parties than doing their civic duty. And even the emperors, who were supposed to lead by example, often turned out to be tyrants or fools. So as morals declined, so did the empire. It took about 300 years, but Rome went from being the world superpower to collapse. The army got weak, and enemies attacked from outside, and the empire couldn't defend itself anymore. By 476 AD, the great Roman Empire in the west was gone. If such a powerful empire can fall apart from the inside out, can any government of this world really last? No matter how good things look, how perfect the government is set up, why do they always seem to go wrong in the end? From ancient Rome to the British Empire, now we are witnessing in real time the rapid decline of this world's current superpower, the United States. Same things keep happening time and time again. It's a never-ending cycle. And this begs the question, why? Why do human governments keep failing, no matter how well thought out and put together they are? First, what is the purpose of government? And the Encyclopedia Britannica defines government as the political system by which a government or community is administered and regulated. And I found six purposes of government. So this is not comprehensive, but it's just a high-level overview and understanding of its functions. And they include creating and enforcing laws. So this is a fundamental role, providing the rules that govern society and the mechanisms to uphold them, to ensure order, maintaining social stability and preventing chaos. It's crucial for a functioning society. Protecting the rights and freedoms of its citizens, safeguarding individual liberties is a key responsibility. Provide essential services. This includes infrastructure, education, healthcare, and other public goods and that benefit society. To promote the general welfare, this broad function covers efforts to improve quality of life, economic prosperity, and social well-being for its citizens. Finally, to resolve conflicts, mediating disputes between individuals, groups, or even other nations is an important role of government. So in essence, it exists to structure society in a way that benefits the common good while protecting individuals and the nation. We look at that, and idealistically, it all sounds great. How could it possibly go wrong? Ronald Reagan, widely considered to be among the most influential and admired presidents in U.S. history, once said, "The nine most terrifying words in the English language are, 'I'm from the government and I'm here to help.'" If a government is supposed to protect you, provide services, promote general welfare, take care of the needy, resolve disputes, why would those words be terrifying? Isn't government a good thing? Well, it just depends on who's running it, doesn't it? You see, every government system on paper works. Democracy, republic, monarchy, dictatorship, communism, socialism, federalism, parliamentary systems. Some offer different advantages and disadvantages, but they all work in theory. It's why you have such staunch supporters of, say, communism, because on paper it all sounds great. Everyone is equal and prosperous. But in practice, it has categorically failed faster than any other system, has led to the deaths of over 100 million people, Yet communist supporters still argue that for that system, they still argue for that system, because all the other times it failed, they'll say that it was implemented wrong. They'll get it right next time. And while communism is a terrible system, because when you really break it down, it's based on coveting, the other systems aren't going to save the world. They'll just fail slower. And why do they fail? Why do all these government systems do that? What is the one thing they all have in common? Well, they have people. These governments are administered by man. And even if you have a benevolent dictator, it doesn't matter, because the benevolence will not last. So let's turn to a couple of scriptures. First, we're gonna read Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. Flip over to Jeremiah 17. Verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? The human heart is a wicked thing. It's human nature, and while every single human government, or the reason why every single human government will crash and burn, it's an inevitability. And this is also the reason why the government of God will succeed, because it will be administered by the God family. Kings and priests that have actively chosen to submit to God the Father and Christ the King, to turn away from sin, to forsake the way of get. We have made that choice to serve God and not be slaves to sin. So today, as we begin this Feast of Tabernacles, a day that marks the beginning of Christ's 1,000-year reign over the earth and the administering of God's government on earth, I want to go over the following. First, Israel had an opportunity to willingly live by God's law and keep His commandments, to implement His way of life into their own, to accept God as their ruler. And this wound up being an endless cycle of failures that ultimately led to Israel rejecting God as their king and crying out for a human king. And despite that, Israel still had opportunities to obey God, to show the other nations how living by God's laws will usher in the most peace and prosperity. And this too failed. Because the government is only as good as the foundation it's built upon, the leaders who administer it, and the people willing to obey the laws set forth by that government. And Israel failed at all. Next, I want to talk about the government of God and how it compares to what is arguably one of the best forms of government man has managed to devise, the government of the United States, and why God's government will succeed where all governments have failed. Finally, God's plan, our purpose, preparing to administer His government under Christ. In order to successfully administer God's government, it must be administered by a perfect being. Satan, when he was Lucifer, had a chance. He was given the keys to the car, so to speak, but he wasn't perfect. He thought he was perfect. And, well, there's the problem. Iniquity was found in him, and we know the rest of the story. It makes me think of the old saying, if you want a job done right, you have to do it yourself. And since Satan and a third of the angels failed administering God's government on earth, God's just going to reproduce himself and have his family administer his government instead. I know I can't be the only one who said, boy, if I could just clone myself, make a few dozen copies, I could get so much done. Well, we're not going to be clones by any means, but the family of God will be unified 100% in how we think. Christ said in John 14, let's turn there real quick, John 14. Christ said to Philip in verse 9, he said, he who has seen me has seen the Father. And he said that because they're of one mind. They're practically the same person because Christ is in full agreement with the Father. It's not like a daughter who might go and ask her dad if she can wear makeup, and the dad says no, so then she goes and asks her mom, and mom says yes. Christ and the Father think the same. There is no disagreement.
That is also why the government of God works perfectly. All administering it are in agreement from the top down. If we continue in verse 10, the words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me. They're on the same exact page. And that's where we are expected to be, to strive for, to have the mind of God, to think like God, to eventually become God, born into the God family. And by then we will be proven capable and entrusted to administer His government, because we will be ruling in the same manner as God Himself. We know man cannot rule himself. It's been that way since the beginning. If we turn back to Genesis 6, verse 5, we see that man is doing what we see what man is doing at his zenith, just before the great flood. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Now, it doesn't help that Satan is there to poke the bear, but ultimately, man chooses to do what man does. You can't say Satan made me do it. Satan never forced anyone to do anything, just like no one forced Satan to become Satan. The thoughts that turned his heart against God were his own. He had free will to choose, just as man does. And speaking of free will, ancient Israel had so many missed opportunities, so many chances to be a working example of man administering God's government. So let's go ahead and turn to the book of Judges. I want to read chapter 2, verse 18 and 19. It pretty much sums up the book. Judges 2. Verse 18. And when the Eternal raised up judges for them, the Eternal was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Eternal was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn ways. Now, in Judges, there's this cycle of sin, deliverance, and temporary obedience throughout. It serves as an example for us today, proving that it's impossible for humans without God's Spirit to obey God of their own accord. A perfect illustration of human nature. They were obedient, not because they loved God and desired to live by His way, by His righteousness. No, they just wanted the pain to stop. And once the bitterness of the punishment from sin wore off, they were right back to sinning. This isn't anything new. And this isn't an indictment on Israel. It's an indictment on carnal man's inability to obey God, no matter how sweet the reward is or how bitter the punishment is. Repeatedly throughout the book, we're told two things. One, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal. And two, in those days, there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So during this time, Israel had no formal government in the modern sense, no king or centralized authority. It was a test for Israel. Will they obey God of their own accord, without having someone, a leader, to tell them to do it? So if we continue down in chapter 3, verse 1 of Judges, chapter 3, verse 1. Now these are the nations which the Eternal left, that He might test Israel by them. And He goes on to name them all in verse 3. Verse 4, and they were left that He might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Eternal, which He had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So we see here that God wanted to know if Israel would willingly follow him as their ultimate king by keeping his laws and commandments. The absence of a human king gave Israel an opportunity to demonstrate to God, to prove whether they would follow his commands out of personal conviction and commitment rather than relying on a human leader to enforce obedience. I think there's a parallel between that time and physical Israel and spiritual Israel, the church, today. Spiritual Israel is divided up. It's each tribe or corporate entity doing their own thing, following God's law as to how they see it. So we turn to Judges 17. Flip over to Judges 17 and verse 6 towards the end. This is the first time this phrase is mentioned. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So this phrase starts being used after Samson, and we're getting closer to Israel rejecting God outright and asking for a human king. But it's indicative of the moral decay of Israel and the inability to govern itself. So we could easily read that passage in parallel with today, as in those days there was no apostle in the church of God. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Many members do what is right in their own eyes, applying God's law how they think it should be applied versus how Christ instructed us through his apostle, Mr. Armstrong. Even the prevailing Laodicean attitude we see today in the church means let the people decide. Decide based on what is right in their own eyes. It's a diametrically opposite governmental system to God's, to democracy. So without a doubt, the church is being judged today, tested today, without having a strong central leader like Mr. Armstrong to set us straight. We're all individually being left on our own to see, will they unconditionally obey God of their own accord? Not because Mr. Armstrong yelled at them and they felt embarrassed about it. And there's a reason for this. God must know that we're going to administer his government. He must know that we're committed, that we're all in, that it's easy to do the right thing when everyone's looking. It's an entirely different animal to do the right thing when nobody's looking, when no one's there to hold you accountable. The time of the judges lasted approximately 300-400 years, represented a missed opportunity for Israel to faithfully follow God, to accept him as their ruler, and live by his laws. Of course, Israel doesn't want to blame themselves for this failure, instead holding themselves accountable. They use Samuel's two sons as an excuse to reject God and call for a human king to rule them. So if we turn to 1 Samuel 8, which marks the end of the judges there, you find that Samuel had appointed his two sons as judges, unlike most of the previously mentioned judges who weren't labeled outright corrupt, though some like Samson had some moral shortcomings. These two specifically are described as bad. As we read in 1 Samuel 8, verse 1, their corruption is apparent. 1 Samuel 8, verse 1, now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. And the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the second Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Instead of Israel saying to Samuel, hey, your sons should not be judges. They're not following God. Let's ask God to remove them. No, they use it as an opening to push for a human government. They've been dying to be like the other nations. Continuing in verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Eternal, and the Eternal said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day I have brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Samuel is upset because he's taking it personally, but this request has nothing to do with him. Israel's demand essentially says to God, your ways don't work for us. We want to do our own thing, live by our own laws, our own government and morality. We want to do it our way. This sounds much like a rebellious teenager rejecting their parents' rule. By making this request, Israel officially rejects God as their ruler. And God responds, all right, I'll play your game. You want to be like the rest of the world? Fine. You can have your king. This is like that rebellious teenager leaving home to live by their own rules. They're no longer under the parents' authority, but they've also lost their parents' protection. However, before granting your wish, God warns them in verse 9. Verse 9, now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel told all the words of the Eternal to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. And he will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariot. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. And he will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Eternal will not hear you in that day. God's warning, though specific to a monarchy in this instance, applies to all forms of human government. It's a universal caution. Eventually, instead of the government serving the people end up serving the government. We can apply God's warning about having a king to today's world. Take the United States, for instance. Replace king with Uncle Sam, the personification of the United States government, and the parallels become clear. Uncle Sam requires every male U.S. citizen to register for selective service within 30 days of his 18th birthday. Like a king, Uncle Sam can draft your sons and send them to war. Through eminent domain, he can take your property. Even if you fully own the property, failure to pay taxes can result in its seizure. Uncle Sam has many servants with expensive tastes. The congressman. Ironically called public servants, these officials often become multimillionaires just a few years after service. This might explain Uncle Sam's insatiable appetite for taxes. In fact, there are well over 800 to 1,000 distinct taxes in the U.S. Some of the more notable are the income tax, the payroll tax, capital gains tax, gift tax, corporate tax, excise tax, self-employment tax, unemployment tax. Why, they even tax you when you're dead. With the estate tax. And we haven't even touched the state taxes, Uncle Sam's little brothers, with their own income, sales, property, excise, vehicle, payroll taxes. I haven't calculated the exact total, but I know about 30% of my paycheck goes to Uncle Sam. This doesn't account for the other taxes that are not deducted directly from my wages. Out of every dollar earned, how much does Uncle Sam and his family actually take? Well, I'm not sure what the Israelites were thinking back then, but I believe a flat 10% tithe to God is much fairer and simpler. Tithing even has its own welfare system built in, with third tithe helping widows and orphans. And that only happens every third and sixth year on a seven-year cycle. The second tithe is hardly a burden either. It ensures we're able to enjoy God's feast days to its fullest, like we are here today. But Israel shouldn't complain. After all, they asked for this back then. They heard God out. Yet still, they said in verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Despite Israel's rejection, God didn't completely abandon his people. Instead, he chose to work within their desire for a human king. Enter Saul. In the beginning, he was a humble guy. In 1 Samuel 9:21, you don't have to turn there, but he doesn't even consider himself worthy of being king, because he's not only from the smallest tribe of Israel, he's also from the least of the families of Benjamin. So you think about it, this guy was handpicked by God. Despite Israel rejecting God, God still tries to find the best leader available, someone that gives Israel the best chance. God didn't have to do that. He could have just said, whatever, let Israel do its own thing. But no, even after being rejected, God does his best to set Israel up for success with Saul. And in a way, it proves a point. Even if the leader is chosen by God himself, it doesn't guarantee success if that leader doesn't follow God, which is exactly what happened with Saul. He started off good, but success went to his head. He disobeyed God and let jealousy consume him. He rejected God and was ultimately replaced with a new line. In a sense, Saul represents the broader struggle of Israel's monarchy. Leaders with potential, a line chosen by God, who fail due to disobedience or seeking human solutions over reliance on God. We see time and time again that this monarchy only works when the monarch is obedient to God. This government worked under King David, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, Josiah, because they obeyed God, but it failed miserably when the king was evil. Couldn't this be said of any form of human government? Governments of the world, when they're successful, are probably following many of God's laws without even knowing it, and they're blessed because of it. But that never lasts. It didn't for Israel, it didn't for the governments of antiquity, and it doesn't for modern governments, as we're seeing right now with modern day Israel. The United States and Great Britain have each had some good, if not great, leaders. Leaders that, to the best of their understanding, did try to at least give credit to God and implement some of his laws. And not surprisingly, it was during these times that the most success was seen. And you could see the blessings being poured out. These two forms of government may be the best that man could devise. And yet, here we are, sitting on the verge of collapse. Scoffers will say, no matter how bad things get, the United States is too big of a superpower to fail. History says otherwise. Prophecy says otherwise. It's funny, that's a tale as old as time, the whole too big to fail. But every time they do, and it's usually not by someone bigger than they are. It's usually by someone smaller and unassuming. Think David and Goliath. I like to watch football, and American football for those of you overseas, and it never fails. Every now and again you get this super team that everyone says can't be defeated. They have all the superstars, the best and greatest athletes, the greatest coaches, and they're just unstoppable. And then one day they get dropped by a team of nobodies. This isn't a phenomenon, it's the human condition that God warns us about. Proverbs 16:18 says, you can turn there, Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. In those situations, you look for pride, you look for that pride, because without fail, you know what's coming. The pride of Satan, for example, in Ezekiel 28:17. I'm going to read this from the Revised Standard Version. Ezekiel 28:17. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes on you. Proud. The king's there, that's going to be us. And it's interesting reading the different translations of that part. The New Living Translation says, exposed you to the curious gaze of kings. And the Moffat translation says, I made you a spectacle before kings. So you have a feast of the eyes, a curious gaze, spectacle. And it sounds like it's not only going to be humiliating for Satan, but the astonishment that this being is the source behind all this mess that we're in today. And because of what? Pride. The same pride that civilization had before the flood, the pride of Babylon, Egypt, Assyria, Greece, Rome, Persia, the pride of the British Empire where the sun never sets, the pride of the United States. We even had a song called I'm Proud to Be an American. However, what does being proud to be an American mean anymore? Seems as if America today is more interested in gay pride and child sacrifice. Those are the hills that they have chosen to die on. And once the collapse of Israel is complete, man will have one more attempt at governing himself, the final human government, beast power, driven by Satan, as man has chosen to align himself with Satan instead of God. And we see how long this lasts, a whopping 3.5 years. You know, even Hitler's Third Reich lasted 12. So this government is going to be so bad, so evil, that we're told in Matthew 24, verse 22, and except those days be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. If God doesn't intervene at this moment, humanity will have created a government that will literally cause an extinction-level event to occur. Some idealists, like Gene Roddenberry, they envision this utopian galactic government as seen in Star Trek. However, this is an unrealistic fantasy. Despite the aspirations of visionaries like Elon Musk, such a future is unattainable. Humanity is more likely to destroy itself before establishing a foothold on another planet. And this stark reality underscores the critical need for God's government. So what exactly is the government of God? What qualities enable this form of government to endure for eternity? What makes it a perfect system? Now, while there are some similarities between human governments and God's government, there are also crucial differences. So let's examine the structure of both. Now, both human government and God's government, they typically have three major branches. You have the legislative branch, which is the lawmaking branch. In the United States, that's Congress. In Britain, that's Parliament. And in God's government, God the Father is the lawmaker. The executive branch, which is your law enforcement branch. In the United States, the head of that is the president. In Britain, the prime minister, and in God's government, it's Jesus Christ. And then you have the judicial branch, the law application branch. In the United States and Britain, you have the Supreme Court, and in God's government, you have Jesus Christ. While these structural similarities exist, there are fundamental differences that set God's government apart from human-made governments. Mr. Armstrong provides the best explanation in an article titled Billions Not Being Judged and Still Not Lost, published in January 1981, issue of the Good News. He explains the nature of God's government. Mr. Armstrong said, so first, learn about the government of God, no longer operative on earth. Of necessity, all government is based on a foundational law or constitution, whether local city government, state government, national government, or the government of God. The government of God is based on His spiritual law. That law is a way of life. It is the way that will produce peace, happiness, contentment, joy, abundance for all, and for mortal man, eternal salvation, immortal life as a God being. It is the way of outflowing love, first in obedience to and worship of God. Secondly, loving human neighbor as oneself. I simplify this way of life by the term give, cooperation, serving, helping, sharing. God Himself is the epitome of that. He is the great giver who Himself is love. The transgression of that spiritual law, I term, get, vanity, covetousness, envy, jealousy, competition, strife, violence, resentment of authority. We have a government that is based on spiritual law, not man's law. It's a law that foundation is reliant on one thing, love. And if we turn to Romans 13, verse 8, owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Skipping down to verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. The word love has been perverted by Satan. The world uses this term liberally. We see it on yard signs, social media posts, and music. However, this is not agape love, but rather an acceptance of lasciviousness. The phrase, love, is often used to promote various forms of fornication and sexual deviancy. And the great gay pride movement has appropriated this term, and liberalism uses it to justify disobeying God's law in favor of individual moral relativism. While the world claims to live by their version of love, it is not the agape love that God intends. Instead, it represents a love for worldly things. We previously examined how pride leads to destruction. To further understand this concept, let's turn to 1 John 2. In verse 15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of the Father abides forever. The governments of this world, particularly in Western nations, often cater to a distorted form of love, one based on pride and lust. True love isn't about yielding to every desire. Any good parent understands this principle. If parents said yes to everything, the child would grow up a delinquent. And that's not love, that's abuse. God's love is selfless and unconditional, always seeking the best for others. It involves discipline for our growth. In contrast, worldly love often prioritizes personal desires and instant gratification, avoiding necessary correction because correction is uncomfortable. Consider the transgender issue that has become prevalent globally. In 2022, the state of California passed a law making it a refuge for gender transition procedures, even for minors without parental consent. Some governments claim to protect children who identify as the opposite sex by removing them from their parents' care and subjecting them to surgeries or hormone treatments. And this is what the world's misguided concept of love advocates. However, it's founded on falsehoods and lies that harm and enslave. True love, as God defines it, would protect children from irreversible decisions they're not equipped to make and uphold the family unit he designed. God's law is rooted in truth. And while truth can sometimes be painful, it ultimately provides genuine liberty, freedom from sin. As we read in James 1, verse 25, James 1, but he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. God's law is perfect because it was created by a perfect being. It will be administered by perfect beings and applied by perfect beings. This is the plan and has been the plan all along. In order for the government of God to work, for any government to work, it has to be administered by perfect beings. Going back to what Mr. Armstrong wrote, Mr. Armstrong continued, behind all creation, there had to be the pre-existence of an almighty creator, of supreme mind, a creator who rules over his creation. That creator placed angels on this earth prior to man to govern them with the government of God. But he placed a super archangel, the cherub Lucifer, on earth's throne. But Lucifer rebelled. He led his angels, a third of all angels, into rebellion. The government of God was no longer administered on earth. Lucifer became Satan the devil. His angels became demons, all with superior but perverted minds. This world used to be under the government of God, but it was administered by an imperfect being, Satan, who could and did rebel and sin. Israel was given the opportunity to administer the government of God, to be a model nation. But as humans are also imperfect beings, they failed. But we know God's plan to restore his government on earth. This time, it will succeed because it will finally be administered by Jesus Christ and the God family. Also, humans to this point do not have the Spirit of God in them, but they will. We read that in Ezekiel 36, 24 through 26. You can put that in your notes. Mr. Bowles read that during atonement. And I'm sure this will be read several more times during the feast. But God is going to put his Holy Spirit into man. Man is going to have a new heart that will no longer be enmity with God. They will no longer be children of Satan. So let's read the prophecy about this restoration. So let's turn to Isaiah 9. Isaiah 9. In verse 6. Isaiah 9 and verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. We read here about this prophecy of the restoration of God's government. You can also put in your notes Daniel 2, verse 44, Zechariah 14, 9, Revelation 11, 15, and Micah 4, 1 through 3. But what about us? What's our role? So let's continue. This is the final excerpt from Mr. Armstrong, from that article. God's purpose was to reproduce himself through mortal man, made from the dust of the earth, to instill within man, by man's own decision and desire, the holy, righteous, perfect, spiritual character of God, converting mortal man into immortal God beings. God purposed through men to restore his government on earth for this dual supreme purpose, restoring his government over the earth and reproducing himself through mortal man. God has devised a master plan for its accomplishment. The Feast of Tabernacles marks the beginning of the restoration of this government. And as first fruits will be part of the executive and judicial branches of God's government under Jesus Christ, kings and priests. Let's read Revelation 5, verse 9. This is the final scripture. Revelation 5 and verse 9. And they sang a new song, saying, You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. We will reign with Christ on the earth. And it's why we're here now, to prepare to administer this government. A government that will never fail, that will exist forever, that will be what man could never and can never achieve on his own. The United States has a Pledge of Allegiance, and it ends with one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It's a wonderful ideal, but it has failed miserably under human government. These are empty words spoken out of memorization. But once the government of God is restored, all nations will be under God in a kingdom that cannot be divided, with a law of liberty and righteous judgment and justice for all.